speaker today. I will take honor of presenting Fritz Mertens. He is a retired Army officer and aerospace executive. He graduated from North Alabama University in 1959 and was commissioned in the Army at that time. His 22-year military career included two combat tours in Vietnam, time duty in Korea and Germany, as well as at four stateside locations at USC, where he received a master's degree in systems management in 1974. Subsequent assignments involved the development of combat vehicles and post-retirement move to Southern California for an aerospace career with Northrop Aerojet. Fritz's wife, Susan, was an elementary school teacher and principal until her retirement in 2006. They have own children or grandchildren, lived in Irvine since 1982.
Thank you. It's an honor to speak to all of you today. I have to tell you, though, you've probably already noticed the title has changed. When I got into this subject, began to think about it, began to talk about it with a few other people, I realized that what I had considered a very significant engagement in Hawk Hill in 1969 was only a minor part of a much larger story that probably needs to be reviewed for some who remember pieces of it and exposed to others who may not be aware. So I decided that I wanted to talk about the entire Vietnam, or the American experience in Vietnam in a more general sense, as well as acquaint you with my little battle on Hawk Hill on the 8th of June, 1969. One of the principles, let me back up. I almost went past a very important thing. E.J. Dionne is a pretty well nationally known political commentator, and he's very liberal, by the way, but he's written a book, and one of the things he tries to do is figure out why we have such a polarized political population today. And he decides that it is because we have lost the study of our history. And in writing about this, he says, if we don't know who we were, we can't know who we are today. And it's kind of in that spirit that I want to go back over the Vietnam experience. Because as you know, the 1960s were a period of change in America. The Vietnam War was only part of that change, but it was probably a significant part. So it's worth thinking about how all that happened and why. And then we saw in the 70s the implementation of the changes that basically the baby boomers had put into effect in the 60s. That forever changed the nature of our country. So that's why we're doing this. One of the unknown principles, or little spoken principles of war, because it's not very profound, unfortunately, is that you can't have a war without a map. Well, I went too far. There we go. Got to get used to this thing. This is Indochina. The territory in light color is the Indochina that the French colonized in 1887. They had been in that part of the world before that, but they formally organized Indochina as a colony in 1887 and began to take a lot of the wealth out of Indochina back to France, very much like the Spanish did in Latin and South America. So the colony of Indochina was being run for the benefit of the French in France, not for the benefit of the Vietnamese people. It's interesting that the Thailand never got involved in any of that. They didn't even become a British colony. They managed to stay independent. So that area of the world is going to remain Indochina until about 1945. Now, the French were kicked out of Indochina as far as running the place was concerned, although they still had some administrative people there when the Japanese occupied in 1940. So the Japanese occupied Indochina from 1940 to 1945. And just before they left in 45, they created three separate countries: Vietnam, Laos in the north, inland, and Cambodia in the south, also inland, also landlocked, so to speak. But now that you've seen the terrain, I guess the next question is, how did all this get started? Who's responsible for the things that went on in Vietnam and the Vietnam War? There he is. Ho Chi Minh was born in the 1890s, I don't know the exact year, in Vietnam, of a fairly well-to-do family. And of course, at that time, all of Vietnam was part of the Indochina French colonial structure. And so it was fairly easy for Ho Chi Minh to get to Paris, which he did sometime in the 1920s, where he started to study communism. He even spent 2 years in Moscow studying communism from the real experts. He was present in 1926 when the French Communist Party was organized in Paris. And he returned then to Asia to start the Indochinese Communist Party in 1930, strangely enough, in Hong Kong. For some reason, I guess he couldn't do it in Vietnam. But Ho, Uncle Ho, which he came to be called, was a committed communist. And that's an important factor to remember, because that's really the thing. And he was convinced that communism was the right system for all of Vietnam, and he wanted to unite Vietnam under a communist form of government. That was the plan of his life, so to speak. So these are the tipping points. Can you read this all right in the back?
Yeah.
Okay. In 1942, Uncle Ho established the Viet Minh, which became the shock troops for his movement, so to speak. I happen to have known an ex-Viet Minh when I was there in 1962. He had switched sides at that point and was part of the military complex for the South Vietnamese. The Viet Minh fought against the French forces when the French tried to take back their colony after the Japanese left in 1945. So the French reoccupied, and the Viet Minh opposed that occupation, to the point where they were strong enough to conduct several conventional battles. You're going to hear me talk about some guerrilla warfare conducted by the VC and a number of conventional battles that occurred later on in Vietnam. I don't know whether the difference is obvious to you, but it's fairly complex. The insurgents, the guerrilla warfare notion is that the Viet Cong were embedded in the population. They looked like other South Vietnamese in the daytime, but the night belonged to Charlie. And so they did most of their work at night, as we will see later. When I refer to conventional battles, I'm talking about soldiers who are either uniformed or equipped in such a way that it's obvious that they are part of a larger force. And so there are two forces that meet in a conventional battle. In 1954, the Viet Minh defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu, again in a conventional battle where the French were isolated in a specific location, and the Viet Minh brought in a lot of artillery and just pulverized them until they surrendered. So that of the French involvement in Vietnam. And at that time, because the communist influence had already begun to grow in North Vietnam, Vietnam was cut in two at the 17th parallel, and the South was going to be democratic and the North was going to be communist. And so a president was elected in South Vietnam, a government set up with a capital in Saigon. The communist government was established in Hanoi. And that was supposed to be the end of it. The truce, which the North never abided by, was supposed to end the struggle and let these two separate countries exist independently. That didn't happen. Because of the influence of the Viet Cong, Viet Minh converted to Viet Cong in South Vietnam to conduct a guerrilla campaign against the South Vietnamese government to try to overthrow it. And they were supplied by North Vietnam and China. Let me go back just a minute. 1948, Harry Truman said publicly that the United States needed to stop the spread of communism in Asia and in Europe. So that was the first time that the challenge had been acknowledged. But if you think back in your history, by the 50s, not only had the Soviet Union taken over a very large portion of Eastern Europe, but the communists under Mao Zedong had taken over China, Chiang Kai-shek out of China. He went to Taiwan. So communism was spreading, and Western nations were concerned. Americans were concerned. American presidents were concerned. So Eisenhower, during his administration, gave a good deal of aid and comfort of supplies and so on to the French after their defeat to the South Vietnamese government. We'll see where we go from there. So that's kind of the beginning of the U.S. Involvement in Vietnam. This is a picture I took in 1962, but it kind of illustrates the sort of relationship that we had during during what I will call Phase One. There are really two phases to American involvement in Vietnam. Phase One was the phase where we did the supporting, the South Vietnamese did the fighting. And we'll see later on that Phase Two is dramatically different from that. The people in the picture, if I go from the right, you'll see Major Betts, who is a who was my boss and an advisor. We put in officers as advisors to Vietnamese units, but not have fighting troops, so to speak. The guy in the tan uniforms is an interpreter. He's a university graduate from Saigon who had mastered English. Doesn't know anything about military tactics. He's just a kid fresh out of school, and his function is to translate for between us and them, so to speak. The guy in the middle is Father Phuc. He's a Vietnamese priest. He's been to Paris several times. He's Roman Catholic, of course. And he was one of the leaders of the opposition to the Viet Cong. He had a church, he had a parish, and he used that influence to organize people in his area against the Viet Cong. And therefore, of course, he was an ally of ours. The guy on the left is his, what we in the Army would call his horse holder, somebody to go along and carry his bags. Now, in this case, he's probably getting on that helicopter to go to Saigon for some reason, courtesy of the United States and the advisors and the helicopters that had been put in there. At this point, by John Kennedy, who, after he became president, decided that we needed to beef up our support in South Vietnam, and therefore sent in helicopter squadrons. Those helicopters are flown by Americans, and a complete helicopter unit. There were several of them in the country, and they supported the South Vietnamese troops, and also, of course, people like me as who were advisors. The problem with phase one was, first of all, we were only learning how to conduct counter-guerrilla operations. The British had some experience in Malaysia, and we were learning from that, but it was a new form of warfare for us. Remember that most of our senior officers, and in fact people like Major Betts, were World War II veterans and Korean War veterans. So they were accustomed to winning a war by pulverizing the countryside, no matter who it belonged to, no matter who got killed in the process. That's how they won the war in Europe and in Asia. So this whole thing about being an advisor was new to them. Occasionally the Army does some dumb things. Actually, often it does some dumb things. And in this case, the dumb thing was to send me as a lieutenant to language school, but not to send Major Betts as a major to language school. So what happened from all of this was the battalion commander that we were advising, a Vietnamese, paid more attention to me than he did to Major Betts because I could speak his language, at least a little bit, enough to get by, so to speak. Major Betts didn't like that very well. And so that created a difficult relationship. But the poor leadership that was available, I think, was the key to the lack of success in the counterinsurgency program. Actually, there are probably other keys that I'll get to in a minute. But you have to remember that Vietnam was organized politically, but not militarily. So we were, in effect, advising a province governor who was appointed by someone in Saigon and was therefore a political appointee, and he was given the rank of colonel, but he may know nothing about military operations, specifically anti-guerrilla operations. So as a result of that, the VC had the run of the rural parts of South Vietnam, especially at night. As soon as we got there, we said to ourselves, the night belongs to Charlie, Charlie being the VC, because it was obvious that we were unable to protect all these little villages from the VC during darkness. And of course, any casualties that the VC incurred, which were significant, could be replaced from sources in North Vietnam, and they were able to send equipment down. As I've mentioned, Uncle Ho was the visible leader. When a VC was killed, you could almost guarantee that there would be a postage stamp size photograph of Ho Chi Minh on his body somewhere. Most of them carried Ho Chi Minh's picture when they went into battle. Maybe a word about us. As far as the Vietnamese people were concerned, we were just a replacement for the French. We even looked like the French, right? So they were probably not too happy to see us even as advisors, but at least we had not taken over the political structure at that point. There was one major battle during what I will call Phase One, the Battle of Ap Bac, 2nd of January 1963, where 2,500 South Vietnamese soldiers, well-equipped regular soldiers, attacked a small force of 350 VC that they knew to be congregated up near the Cambodian border. The VC won. They inflicted major casualties on the South Vietnamese troops, caused them to withdraw. They shot down about 5 U.S. helicopters, which happened to be from the base next to where I was living, so I knew some of the pilots involved, and illustrated the fact that the South Vietnamese Army was not prepared to fight for South Vietnam. Maybe this picture explains why. You've heard the phrase hearts and minds. Well, the overriding strategy on our part was to win the hearts and minds of the South Vietnamese people. Convince them that democracy was better than communism. And just the way I said that, you can tell about how well that went over. These are people who had never heard of either one. These are families of what you might call peasant soldiers. They were rice farmers who had been told that if they would train as soldiers and inhabit this little fort and try to protect the surrounding village or whatever, they'd be paid a small amount of money, which of course eventually came from the American taxpayer. And that worked, of course. It's a nice recruiting tool. And they brought their families with them. But there was no foundation, either in education or in leadership, for this notion that we could convince these people like this, who were simply trying to subsist, that they should support the South Vietnamese government. A couple other things bear on this problem. South Vietnam had already been fighting. Well, Vietnam had been for 20 years already, ever since the Japanese left. Actually, ever since the Japanese got there. You remember that the Viet Minh were organized in 1942. Well, by 1962, they'd been at it for 20 years. So an awful lot of the capable South Vietnamese leadership had been killed off. Also, of course, the people were tired of all this fighting, and they realized that their best bet was to hunker down. So they were in a situation where in the daytime they were for the government, and in the nighttime they were for Charlie, the VC. And we ran into a number of cases where in a single house you would have both flags. One of them hidden away, the VC flag hidden away, but if we searched the house we would find it. And the South Vietnamese flag that would be displayed while we were in the neighborhood, so to speak. So it wasn't working very well. Our strategy then had to be to work with the leadership that we were dealt. And we tried to do that. This is me with the boat platoon leader in Sock Trang, a fellow that I advised to a limited extent. Let me introduce you to Captain Larson, which I think his experience illustrates the difficulty that we faced. Captain Larson was a Korean War veteran. As an enlisted man, he had gotten a commission, and he was, so at this point he was an infantry captain. He had been to the infantry school at Fort Benning, very knowledgeable of infantry tactics, both from Korea and from his schooling. So he was the right guy to advise, not command, advise the combat center where the South Vietnamese, the local South Vietnamese authorities were turning peasants into soldiers. Good idea. So Captain Larson, in his infinite wisdom, decided the first thing they needed to do was teach these people how to shoot. Makes sense. But before you teach someone how to shoot, according to the Fort Benning doctrine, I guess, you have to find out whether or not they can see. Okay, that makes sense. So he decided to take the 100 or so students that he had and determine whether or not they could pass an eye test. Well, he wasn't so dumb, so he went to local village, talked to the doctor, and brought back a Vietnamese eye chart. Makes a lot of sense. So they could at least read letters in their own language. Well, the first five did great. No problem. Quickly read the chart. They could see. A couple of others fell out. But by the time we got to number 15, about half of the potential soldiers couldn't read the eye chart. And this perturbed Captain Larson no end. So he got the interpreter, said, "What's going on?" Well, interpreter's from Saigon, what does he know? But he goes over to the group that has fallen out, the ones who couldn't read, talks to them for a few minutes, comes back to us. We're all standing around with Captain Larson listening to this. And he says, "Sir, the problem is that most of these men are Cambodians. They can't read Vietnamese." And this is the kind of disconnect that we ran into throughout this period when we tried to advise the South Vietnamese. Now there's I promised to try to bring a little bit of soldier lore into this conversation. And the fact is that most of us have the idea that the army's everything went to hell as soon as I left. Well, we're going to see. Oh, by the way, we also had visiting firemen from I forgot about this chart. Sorry, from Saigon. The guy in khakis is from Saigon. The guy with his back to us is an interpreter, and he's inspecting some troops that have been lined up for the occasion. Now, what you can't see very well is the troops in the front rank with their hands down are holding weapons, the M3 carbines. But if you look carefully between the ranks, you can see that the rear rank is carrying spears. And, you know, that's the kind of unequal situation we were dealing with. At least this fellow came down from his cozy BOQ room in Saigon to check things out. I'm glad he did, but probably didn't do a whole lot of good. There were also, I should have pointed out that the South Vietnamese were highly organized. The province chief, province governor organized everyone into some kind of military force. In this case, medals were being awarded to people who had performed some heroic action in combat, the guys in black on the right, and to the widows of soldiers that had been killed, the women to the left. So this, and you can see it's a fairly large contingent of troops have been drawn up for the occasion. Now, here's where everything went to hell. First of all, John F. Kennedy is assassinated, I think it's the 23rd of November. LBJ takes over. So a big shift in emphasis is going to occur. But what is often forgotten is by that time, President Nguyen, the president of South Vietnam since, I think, the mid-50s, so 5 years or so, is assassinated. A lot of talk has gone on about that being, about our CIA having engineered that change because they couldn't get a lot of cooperation out of President Nguyen. But anyway, for whatever reason, he was assassinated by Vietnamese troops as part of a coup, and big men, a general in the Vietnamese army, took over as president. That is the beginning of 12 different presidents of South Vietnam from 63 to 75. They never had stable national leadership throughout that entire period. And that, of course, is one of the problems with phase one, especially, but also phase two as well. So because LBJ had become president, LBJ didn't want to be a war president. He said so publicly. He wanted to get this war over with. He appointed Westmoreland commander in June of 64. Remember that LBJ had taken over in November of 63, so about a year later, or a little less than a year later, and as a result of that, ordered a bombing of North Vietnam and a buildup of U.S. troops. So now we're beginning to talk about combat troops, U.S. combat troops entering Vietnam. I think he started with 40,000. But we are also starting with the draft in order to provide the level of troops that Westmoreland said he wanted, there had to be a draft. And so the draft is reinstituted in the United States to the consternation of many, and some of whom went to Canada to avoid the draft. So all of these things changed the dynamic in Vietnam substantially. So now we enter phase two. This picture is 69, so it's a little ahead of itself, but suffice it to say that there was a buildup of U.S. troops that went to 549,000 by 1968, so a very substantial U.S. presence. The map changed. Got to have a map. If you see the light red lines, they show province boundaries. So that's what Vietnam looked like during phase one. But if you look at the dark red lines, and unfortunately my pointer's not working with that, so I can't show you that. But there are three or four dark red lines. Those are U.S. Corps boundaries. Corps has divisions in it, so fairly substantial size organization, maybe 150,000 troops, in each one of those four areas. We organized into four corps zones. The arrow is simply showing you where Hawk Hill is in First Corps that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So we've superimposed a military organization on a political organization. The political organization pretty much went to zero. They stopped fighting because we were more energetic than they, for a number of reasons, because we had more equipment than they did, and they were tired. So that's not good. This map shows the movement of large numbers of North Vietnamese troops into South Vietnam. One of the things I forgot to tell you about Johnson's plan for the war was, number one, he didn't want to see any civilian casualties, and therefore he was very selective about what bombing could be done in North Vietnam. But also, he decided we could not violate the integrity of Laos or Cambodia. So we couldn't put any troops in those areas that the North Vietnamese were using to bring their troops south. They had no such scruples. So as you can see, the troops from the north are coming down without being interfered with in Laos and Cambodia, and then turning out into South Vietnam to attack. The North Vietnamese had changed their tactic substantially. They knew they couldn't win with a guerrilla operation based on a large number of troops that we had put in. So they started sending large numbers of troops, uniformed soldiers in most cases, down to fight an essentially conventional battle. That's a map of the area where I operated in 1969, and each one of those little dust-ups shows where a major skirmish occurred or major battle occurred during 67 and 68, and there were quite a few of them. And we repeated battles in almost the same place in 69. For example, one of those to the south is the pineapple forest, which was just that, a big grove of pineapple trees, and it offered pretty good cover for a North Vietnamese unit to come down and occupy. So there were several battles in the pineapple forest before I got there, and we had one shortly after I got there in 1969. January 30th, 1968 is the Tet Offensive. The North Vietnamese saw that they were not doing well militarily. They'd suffered several defeats by that point, and they decided on a massive 100-city offensive to try to win the war in one fell swoop, so to speak. About 85,000 troops participated. They were able to penetrate to the center of Saigon, which was including the U.S. Embassy, which so that was of concern. The casualties they caused to the U.S. or to South Vietnamese were pretty insignificant, and they lost a major portion of their fighting force. But Cronkite reported about a month later to the effect that this was a major defeat for the Americans. As you can see, the last line says this is the brink of cosmic disaster, whatever that means. By the way, all of Cronkite's message at that time, if there's more to it, is available online. All you have to do is Google Cronkite, and it will come up pretty quickly. In a lot of ways, that's a turning point, not militarily, because the VC lost most of their troops in that offensive. But as far as U.S. regard for how the war was going back in the States. Now I need to talk a little bit. I'm getting warm for some reason, so I'm going to sit down if you don't mind. I hope I'll be able to still be heard. I was in an armored cav squadron, and an armored cav squadron is created basically to participate in big battles on the plains of Europe against other armored forces. We had M48 tanks, as you can see here, 61 of them. Each one has three machine guns in addition to the 90 millimeter main gun. Second, we had 70 ACAVs. These are 113s, to which are mounted with one 50 caliber machine gun. Originally, and we added two M60 machine guns on each side. So lots of the message is lots of firepower. And I'll just go through these couple of pictures quickly just to show you what these formations might look like when they're actually out in the field. This is a scene at Hawk Hill, which I'll talk about briefly right now. Fairly flat terrain. Rice paddies all around, a small Vietnamese village nearby, pretty well protected, I would say. Lots of sandbags. Oh, and by the way, if the U.S. Army ever goes to war again, buy plywood futures, because price of plywood is going up. Most of the bunkers and so on are made of plywood and sandbags in one way or another. This is the bunker where I spent 6 months of my life. And as you can see, you can imagine that a lot of it is plywood with sandbags to protect me. Because I was field grade and the third ranking officer, I had the shower close by, which you can see over to the left. Now you see those mountains in the background. Those are places that an armored cav squadron couldn't go. That was left to the infantry battalions. There were a lot more of them. They had a lot harder fight, because when they met up with a sizable North Vietnamese force, they were more or less equal. We might have a little more ammunition if we could carry it, or if a helicopter could drop it in. But beyond that, the infantry battalions, when faced with a North Vietnamese battalion, were pretty much on a par. In fact, the AK-47 was probably a superior rifle to the AR-16 that our troops carried. So the North Vietnamese developed a technique that they called grab the enemy by the belt. And what that meant was that they would get as close to the U.S. forces as they could and fight a very close battle, because that prevented the use of U.S. air power, which our troops wouldn't use for fear of hitting their own troops. And it was pretty effective in many cases. The Tactical Operations Center, there was no hiding anything. We were there. This is a sketch of the wire, and the arrow shows the attack on the morning of June 8th. It's a little deceiving because it looks small, but it was about a little over a mile in any direction across this area, as you can imagine, to facilitate places for all these vehicles and the about 1,400 people that lived at Hawk Hill. So I've got to go quickly. 1 o'clock, a soldier goes out to take a leak, and naturally he doesn't go to the latrine. He goes to the wire, the concertina wire that's everywhere around the perimeter. And while he's there, he thinks he sees a body outside the wire, something out there. So he goes back and gets a starlight scope. Starlight scope has a tube in the middle that amplifies light 1,000 times. So if there's a little bit of light coming in the lens, it's amplified by the tube and it can be very visible at the eyepiece. Very valuable piece of equipment for us, because it allowed us to take back at least part of the night from Charlie. And you can imagine that if one or two flares or searchlight were turned on, that light would be amplified and therefore we could see better. So we didn't know how many people were out there. Alpha Troop opened up around 1 o'clock as a result of this guy's discovery. And so they were shooting up the countryside. That woke everybody else up. There were, maybe I should have showed you on that chart, there are actually 4 troops. Charlie Troop over on the upper left, Bravo Troop on the upper right, Headquarters Troop lower right, and Alpha Troop where the arrow is on the left side. So everybody's awake, everybody's looking for the enemy. We don't know whether there are 12 people out there or 1,200 people out there at that point. But it was relatively quiet until about 4 o'clock when a couple of our NCOs decided they were going to go dink hunting. Another aspect of soldiering is that soldiers always invent derogatory names for the enemy. You may remember that there were Japs and Krauts in World War II. There were Chinks and Slopes in Korean War. We had Dinks. And I understand every now and then I hear a reference to a raghead in terms of Afghanistan. So it's a normal thing. But anyway, Sergeant Major Ogas is 6'8 and weighs about 300 pounds. And so when he goes dink hunting, he doesn't carry an M16 rifle. He carries an M60 machine gun, which is a lot heavier and has... So I can remember him going off into the night with this M60 machine gun in his hand and a big, long belt of ammunition. It looked like Pancho Villa. Big, long belt of ammunition going over his shoulder. And so they were going to go find out whether or not there were any enemy inside the wire. So I'm running out of time here, but at dawn, the show was over. And our troops went out and found that they had killed 7 of the enemy, and we captured 5. And they were in the right, they had been in the rice field. This fellow was in the wire and he's dead. These are the prisoners that we captured. Their primary weapon was a block of explosives that they intended, after they got inside our wire, to go from bunker to bunker or to a combat vehicle, throw it in and blow it up from the inside, so to speak. That's why you don't see any weapons. The team leader carried a pistol, and that was the only weapon that they had. Unfortunately, there's a sequel to this. By the way, we were euphoric that we had defeated this attack, because many other battalions had had bad experience with attacks of this nature. But in August, they came back again. At this point, we had withdrawn three of the four troops, so there was only one troop left on Hawk Hill, and it was scheduled to leave. We were going to abandon the place entirely to move the squadron to division headquarters. So they attacked again on August 12th, when C Troop occupied, and they were successful. At least we would consider them successful. They killed 12 of our soldiers, wounded 45, and of course they paid the price as well. We killed 25 of the enemy in that engagement. But it shows you a lot of persistence. In summary, these are the major battles. As you can see, I mentioned Outbach at the beginning. There were several battles down to Hamburger Hill, which occurred just after Nixon had taken over. And Nixon decided that we could go into Laos and had a couple of forays into Laos, one of which resulted in battle at Hamburger Hill, which was in Vietnam, but right on the border with Laos, where about 350 U.S. troops were killed. Kind of a stalemate, if you will, because they were up against a pretty sizable North Vietnamese force that had come through Laos and was about to go into Vietnam. After that, the last four battles, by the way, Nixon announced a Vietnamization program and the intent to turn the war over to the Vietnamese, which he did. The incursion into Laos was intended to try to help the South Vietnamese defend themselves later on, which didn't work. The four last battles, including the fall of Saigon, were lost by the South Vietnamese, and therefore Saigon was taken after a period of about 5 years. So I guess that one of the questions is, who are the heroes? For my mind, guys like Sergeant Major Ogass, who and the entire NCO Corps were the heroes, because they didn't ask to go to Vietnam. They didn't ask to go to Hawk Hill. But when given orders by people like me, they carried them out faithfully. When faced with the enemy, they charged to meet the enemy, and that's what soldiers are supposed to do. I think the other heroes are these guys. They probably didn't know what democracy and communism were about either, but they were highly motivated by their North Vietnamese leadership and willing to take on units like I have described that ours were, because we were a great thorn in the side of the North Vietnamese coming down. They were trying to get rid of us. I think the notion of who the heroes were maybe is the penultimate question. I'm going to leave you with the final question, which I think relates somewhat to the to the mission of your organization. I'm not going to try to answer this one. But we have Westmoreland on the left, Lyndon Johnson in the center, Ho Chi Minh on the right, Richard Nixon down below on the left, and Walter Cronkite. Those are your choices. And I've unfortunately used an awful lot of time. I apologize for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.